This is Moreno Harav Shlita, and the series is given at Ilo Nishas, Rashlita Bas Rukhayim. His yotzeit was on the 29th of Iyar. This is Freilich, who I remember well myself. Yes, today's series is going to be a bit different to the usual style, and slightly an unconventional, but I'll start with something conventional. What better thing to talk about is there than the Akdomus, which we are going to read in shul tomorrow morning. Gvuron omin lei velos pekrush so gvil ilu ki e kne kol kush so di yo ilu ya me ve khol me khin ish so di yo ya ros of ray rosh me rash va so. Well, I've got the art scroll here, so I can cheat. Hashem's eternal strength cannot possibly be described in its amazing infinity. Even if all the heavens were like parchment, and all the forests were like quills of feathers with which to write, if all the oceans of the seas were ink, and if all the earth's inhabitants were scribes, then still, with all that, there would not be enough to write down all the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I know Shavuos, we're not just thinking about flowers and cheesecake. It's a special time for Kabbalah Satorah. Kabbalah Satorah being the biggest revelation of all to mankind. But really, Kabbalah Satorah for us is every single day. Every day we learn something new, that's a Kabbalah Satorah. And the Akdomus is reminding us about the greatness of Hashem and nature. And though we discussed in the past, there are a number of ways of acquiring Emunah. We've got experience, we've got the miracles of our history to go by. That's one way of ascribing to Emunah. And another way is just to look around, to look at nature. And that's how Avraham Avinu became a person who believes in Hashem. There are nevertheless some people around us who are blind to what's going on around in nature. And they believe that we come from monkeys, and that everything is an accident. And despite the fact that a dolphin, for example, has an inbuilt radar system, despite the fact that we've seen so many amazing things about nature around us, people still walk around blindly. A very well-known book was written some 30 or 40 years ago by Rav Avigdor Miller Zatzal, Rejoice, O Youth, in which he went through the fallacies of the evolutionists. And I don't believe anybody here still believes that we come from monkeys. Thank you. But we have to know how to answer the Abikorosim. And what's fascinating, I found, is that since that time of his publication, and it was so much talked about in the 1960s and in the 1970s, since that time, there have been so many interesting discoveries that it's worth looking at those just to reinforce those ideas and the values which have been identified. Now, in general terms, Chazal always knew that we would discover things later on in the world of the 20th century. The Zohar actually says that in the time of the 6th millennium, in the 600th year of the 6th millennium, which is corresponding roughly to the year 5600, the gates of wisdom will start to open to the gates of mankind. And that was the time of the Industrial Revolution. And if we just simply know that in this very room, in this very room, if I would now keep quiet, there will nevertheless be not hundreds, but thousands of thousands, if not millions, of sound waves, of radio waves passing through this room. You can't hear them, but they're there. Because if you switch on a radio transmitter in this room, you can manage to pick up dozens, hundreds, thousands of stations. If you switch on your mobile phone, you will be picked up from somebody in Australia if they desire to do so. In the same way, if there were a television transmitter in this room, dare I say the word in such an audacious, such a spacious place, you will pick up pictures which are transmitted through the air. So you can't see these. You don't even know they're there when you walk in the room, but they are there. That in itself gives us something about the amazing aspects of the Bria, that there are things going on around us we can't see, we can't identify. Who can understand how the animal kingdom en masse knew that there was going to be a tsunami disaster last 26th of December? They were escaping away from the seaside up into the hills. They knew that something was going. How did they know? We don't know. But they knew, we didn't know. One of the most well-known scientists who still cling on to the idea of the evolution theory, based on Darwin, who wrote The Origin of Species in 1859, is somebody called Richard Dawkins. He's a professor of science at Oxford University. He's called the Professor of the Public Understanding of Science. And just recently, on May the 21st, he wrote an article into the Times to criticise whom he calls the creationists. And in his article, there's a picture of a chimpanzee holding a book reading The Origins of Man. You see, in the last few years, just in the last few years, there's been a growing movement, especially in America, called the creationist movement, where scientists have come to the conclusion that there is no way you can understand science in any possible way other than by the fact that there is a super intelligent design behind creation. And yet he, Professor Dawkins, who admits openly that he is a strong atheist, refuses to accept it and continues to try and argue his case from a theory which postulated in 1859, already a very long time ago, long, long before modern science as it's known today, particularly microbiology, has been known. Now in America they were very keen to make sure that they don't mix the concepts of religion and state, so the idea of creationism has become an unpopular word there where they discuss teaching it in schools. So the creationists had to concede that they can't call it that because it might be regarded as a religious term, chas v'shalom. So now they've renamed creationism intelligent design. And there is still going on this debate between this Richard Dawkins and others who are eminent professors in their field. The most well-known scientist in his field to show up creationism is somebody called Michael Behe, B-E-H-E. And he wrote a very well-known book called Darwin's Black Box, published not very long ago. And there you've got a picture on the front of a human skull and a monkey. Darwin's Black Box, written by Michael Behe, shows one after one how the Darwin theories shown from modern biochemistry are impossible to accept. What is very interesting, which Professor Aaron Recht told me, is that if you look at this fellow's name, Michael Behe, Chazal tell us, Olam Nivro Behe. Hayero Vayvoka Yom Hashishi, and there's a special hay in Bereshis, Ha'olam Nivro Behe. So it can't be a coincidence that this fellow's name is B-E-H-E, although it's not pronounced Behe. Maybe it is, I don't know, but that's him. But for the moment then, I'll do something by handing around one handout today. It's not from a Gemara, it's not from a Chazal, it's not from Mishnayos, it's not from Shulchanav. It's from the Times of Letters page of May the 25th. So if you pass that round. That's right. Yeah, we're not talking about the Tory rank and file on leadership race. And we're not talking about failing gifted pupils. We're looking at the other heading on the right-hand side. It's really the second letter I want to read out, although the first one attacks Richard Dawkins as well. The first letter from a doctor from the Department of Molecular Biology and Biotechnology at Sheffield University. He says, like many biologists, Richard Dawkins views the theory of intelligent design merely as an attack on evolution and being essentially identical to the anthropic principle. It has far wider implications. Such ideas should not be dismissed simply because they have been hijacked by creationists. So here is somebody who's sitting on the fence, but he's criticising Dawkins. He says, rational criticism of evolution and a distaste for biological reductionism do not equate to religious fundamentalism, etc. Bigotry should be resisted. That's not really the letter I wanted to bring out. It's the next one. Is Professor Andy McIntosh from, he's the Professor of Thermodynamics and Combustion Theory at Leeds University. He says, by building a straw man of creationists, supposedly misquoting Darwin, Lewontin is widely quoted by Michael Behe as well as Dawkins. Professor Dawkins labels the lot as ignorant and skirts the big issue. There is no hard evidence for molecules to man evolution. Dawkins has long tutored stories on how the eye and other organs came into being by supposed slow evolutionary processes. But there's no experimental evidence, even if one did accept the fossils as a record of such changes, because really there aren't any fossils. We won't go into the Cambrian explosion issue, which is the next sentence, but it talks about having found in the fossils some of the most sophisticated eyes ever known to have existed. See, the problem is, if there is such a thing as evolution, then you will find a half-baked eye. You will find something which is slowly progressing into something complete, but they've never found it. They have found the most sophisticated eyes, even in the most old fossils. The compound eyes of trilobites have double kikite lenses which defeat any slow evolutionary explanation. And what is more, they have no precursor in the rocks. The non-evolutionist side of the argument is growing, not because of ignorance, but because of the rise of knowledge about the real facts of science without the fairy tale additions of evolutionism. A growing number of academics on both sides of the Atlantic are attracted to the straightforward logic of scientific reasoning. The logical coded machinery of DNA and the information system it carries shout design to an unprejudiced mind. Dawkins's defense is based not on scientific facts, but on ideology. Evolutionary thinking is teetering as a way of looking at the evidence, not because of some isolated problems here and there, but because the whole structure is scientifically wrong. So here's somebody who's not talking from anything to do with Yiddishkeit, nothing whatsoever. He's not expressing any religious view. He's just saying that as an eminent scientist, as a professor myself, I am saying that all this theory, which has been going on for over 150 years, is a load of rubbish. And let's just look a little bit more detail then into the approach which is taken by Michael Behe and his colleagues. He explains that the whole problem is, it's not really how science works, but how science came to be. So you can be a very, very clever scientist who can explain how this works and how that works, but you haven't yet explained how it came about. And says Behe, this is the problem of the evolutionists. Now Darwin himself, if you read his book very carefully, from 1859, actually refers in his introduction to the Creator. And his theory was that the Creator made some form of animal being, and from that evolved and progressed to other kinds of beings. And if that's the case, Darwin never denied the existence of God. He was accepting it. All that Darwin then was doing wrong was we believe that everything Hashem created was according to its own species, Laminehu. And that Darwin went against. So in that respect, we need to challenge it as well. But the hijacking of the atheists of Darwin was to try and show that everything just happened by accident, or that there was a big bang, and somehow this evolved, and somehow that evolved, and because there were millions and millions of years, anything could happen in that period of time. And that is the way many people still, unfortunately, think today. Now, Darwin was very ignorant of reasons for variations in various species, and he didn't understand anything about microbiology because it didn't exist yet. that biochemistry has identified a molecular basis for it. I don't want to get technical, I'm not really a scientist myself, don't worry. But the word evolution can mean different things. What does it really mean then in this context? It's a process of life from non-living matter, developing by some form of natural means. Now there can be microevolution and there can be macroevolution. Behr says that microevolution can occur. What does microevolution mean? If the beak size of a finch bird starts altering its size over a period of time, adapting to its environment, he says that can well happen. Or that the colour of the moth can become lighter when you use less soot in your pollution. So the colours of the moth might gradually change. Or, in the medical world, it's unfortunately found that certain viruses will not respond to antibiotics. That's also a kind of change. That can be a microevolution. And there is no kafira in accepting that, because it is a fact of life that this happens. What Behr says the problem is what's called macroevolution. Macro is a huge jump, and he gives a moshul. He gives a moshul. If a person says, I jumped over a ditch, and the ditch was only 4 feet wide. So he's out, very good, very nice. You're nice and sprightly and fit. Okay. If a person says, I jumped over a ditch, which is 8 feet wide, ooh, then you're going to be impressed. Whoa, this guy's really fit. So let's say a person, you say to him, see that ditch over there which is 15 feet wide? Try jumping over that. He then start trying to make excuses. Well, I've got a sprained knee. I don't think I'm going to manage that one today. And if you then suggest, or even think, that a person might be able to jump over a 100-foot canyon, you know he will not be able to do it. All right, he might be able, through various butts which stick out, to make one jump here and a little jump there, but he will not be able to cross that canyon. Now that's how he describes the idea of macroevolution. And you might find things which don't appear logical in one sense, but appear logical in another way. What's very interesting is that the follow-up to Michael Behr's book by some other scientists, it's called the Weathersfield Institute, I can lend out a copy if anyone wants it, is that the writer who praises Behr also quotes the Rambam. He says, the guide to the perplexed of Maimonides. And he quotes the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim, who writes, why should one part of the night sky have 10 stars and another part of the sky have no stars? It is design, says the Rambam, it's nothing strange, and it is made for a purpose. The position and the magnitude and the numbers are all design. And he quotes it in his book, page 188 of the English translation. I found that fascinating, that you should quote the Rambam on this. Darwin himself accepted that for evolution to have occurred on the human eye is something which is very hard to accept. And he said maybe we might still discover something in the future. Because if the slightest part goes wrong, nothing will function. It's involved in so many different intricate and complex parts. Similarly, in anything else in what's called molecular machines in biochemistry, it comes from proteins which build living tissue and carrying out chemical reactions, and these are all very complex, with things depending on each other. Behr talks about the analogy of the mouse trap. What is a mouse trap? It's got a little wooden platform at the bottom. It's got a sort of hammer on it. It's got a spring. It's got a catch. And it's got the metal bar, which will hold the catch until it's triggered by the mouse. Now, which part of the mouse trap, he says, can be missing and still be able to catch a mouse? It's impossible, he says. If the bar, which is there, is slightly too short, or if the spring is slightly too tight, or if the spring is slightly too heavy, then the mousetrap won't work. So there is a fine balance. It's not just that you've got to have all the components there. They have to have the right sort of density or weight and balance. So he gives a few examples of the of things in nature. He first talks about a certain kind of beetle, the Bombardier beetle, which is a beetle which is only half an inch long. And what's amazing about this beetle is that it can squirt out against any other insect attacking it a very boiling hot liquid. So hot that its steam arises from this liquid. It's boiling point. So how does it make such a solution, this beetle, he says? He says it's a mixture of two main chemicals, of hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone, and the two are mixed together only in a certain way through a special tube, and there are thousands of components inside this beetle which enable this chemical reaction to happen. For this, what happens, it just comes out like water. It just degenerates into water, but it's so boiling hot. He says, how can this go on through any stage of evolution for this beetle to have survived its predators? He says, there is no way it can be half made. It's either or nothing. There or not at all. He then gives another example. He says, if the evolutionists believe what they believe, then you will get a natural progression from another Al-Ajri, skateboard, if you want to travel, then you can get a toy wagon, and then you can move a bit up in the world. If your mum and dad give you enough pocket money, then you can buy yourself a bike. And the next progression after the bike is the motorbike, and then comes, of course, the car. And after the car, you can get an aeroplane, then you can get a jet plane, and then you might be lucky enough to get yourself a space shuttle. He explains this as a mushroom. He says the whole problem with Darwin's theory is that there is a kind of assumption that a bike is like a physical precursor to the car. It can't work that way. You might be able to find some sort of little motor which you will attach to a bike and somehow make it move with a motor to make it a motorbike. Yeah, fine. But to get that motorbike into a car, he says the change, it's not that it's a physical one, it's a conceptual one. And because the conceptual one is different, it's impossible for one to evolve into another. In the same way, he talks as an analogy about swimming, about all the different important parts in the body which are needed in order for you to swim in the water. There are nerve impulses which travel from the brain to your arm muscles, which stimulate them to contract in a specific order. The muscles contract against the bones, causing numerous, something called the humerus, to rise and rotate. The other muscles squeeze the finger bones to make a kind of cupping. To force your arm and hand, you need to act like a propeller going forward. Or what if you forget to breathe? You'll start going black. You need energy. So he there describes what's called the cilium. The cilium is something in which the cells in the body are swimming. Cells have to travel. For example, sperm swims along using a cilium, C-I-L-I-U-M. This cilium, he says, has thousands and thousands of parts to it. And if each part, one part of these thousands are missing, it won't work. And if that won't work, then the cell can't swim. And if the cell can't swim, then the human body won't function. So in a simple term, you have a car and you've got spark plugs and you've got a distributor and you've got an engine. If just one little part is missing, if a spark plug is missing, the whole car won't work. That's how he explains, in modern biological way, how this whole theory is rubbish. This ciliary motion, he writes quite a bit about, is something which has connectors and linkers which tug onto other strands, and he said it's millions of times more complicated than the mouse trap. And if you look at the scientific papers, or what scientists have written about this cilium or cilia, he says there are about 10,000 papers written about it, but not one of them describe on how it's developed. How it currently works, yes, but not how it's developed. He says it's of staggering complexity, with so many hundreds of parts. He says if Darwin would have understood what the cilium is, he would have looked very forlorn. He then gives another analogy about what's called the Rube Goldberg. I don't know if it's got a Jewish relation. But this was a cartoonist who used to describe lots of silly machines, and people used to then end up in lots of laughter. Like the chicken which picks away at the dollar bill, which is tied to a string, and that string is tied to a stick, which is propped up against the ball. So that ball then moves and falls onto a seesaw, and the seesaw then moves and sends up a rock which has sandpaper on it, which moves against the match, which strikes into a flame, and it lights a fuse, which strikes off a cannon, and the cannonball is fired, and it starts a saw, and that saw is a circular saw which cuts into a rope, and that rope is holding a pole, and that pole then falls onto somebody's head. He says, that's a bit unlike the mousetrap, because the mousetrap is one feature with everything needed for each other just to act on its own. But the other aspect of understanding biochemistry is to know that there is a progression of movements which has to happen inside the human body and the animal kingdom and so on. And that also doesn't exist with such a theory. It can't work. Then he wonders whether Darwin would have ever in his expeditions cut a finger or grazed his knee. He says, once you've got a bit of blood coming out on your finger, what is really happening to you? Don't get frightened. Baruch Hashem, it heals up. Suddenly a little clot forms. The blood congeals and dries. And then, eventually, the wound is healed. And soon, you'll see that it was as if it was never there in the first place. He says, this idea of clot formation was never understood till well over 100 years later. For example, if you pierce a hole in a milk carton, that milk will flow out. With the animal kingdom, if the same would happen, the animal would bleed to death. What happens? Something hardens. The body knows it's got to act. Something comes into action. But what if it just overdoes it slightly? What if that little blood clot on your wound heals up, but a bit too much blood hardens? Just a slight amount more. Then you might get a blood clot, chas v'shalom, which could kill you. And people who have problems with blood are on drugs for blood thinning to make sure blood clots don't occur. Because otherwise they can cause heart attack, strokes, and rachmon of its long. He says the activity of your DNA and your blood to work together to create that wound healing up is the chances of 10 to the power of 18. Which he says that if you get a million people playing a lottery, it would take 1,000 billion years for one person to win. That's the chance of it happening. If the food you eat translates properly into your own body, to your own needs, into your own DNA, the chances of it happening properly is 10 to the power of 60. That means to say that the piece of chulut, which is eaten by Reb Gershon Hepner, has to translate itself somehow and miraculously into Gershon's DNA in order to give him that nourishment to survive for another week till he gets his next portion of chulut. We spoke about 10 to the power of 18 about your chances of winning a lottery. 10 to the power of 60 is with the food. He gives many other examples. The internal defense systems, the immune system. There are trillions, he says, of cells which are special. You have a particular illness, chas v'shalom, there is a particular antibody which forms. Out of trillions of cells, he says. This can't evolve, he said. It has to be there from the beginning. Because if it's not there from the beginning, then life wouldn't have survived. He gives another analogy of the Greek mythology of King Midas. Or is it Midas? Midas. That everything he touched turned to gold. Wonderful. Make a fortune out of it. I touch the cream cheese, turns to gold. I touch the bagels, turns to gold. Problem was, he touched his food, it also turned to gold, so he couldn't eat it. He touched his daughter, when he gave her a hug, she turned into a gold statue. what's the message which comes from that mashal? He says, you do need certain powers to do certain things, but the ability has to be there to switch it on and off. It's all very well being able to turn into gold mundane matters which are throwing into the dustbin, but there are other things which you can't afford to have turned into gold. And that's how the human body works. It knows to distinguish between one thing and another thing, when to react, when not to react. He gives other examples about DNA replication, the idea of electron transport, photosynthesis is something which people are familiar with. And in his final chapter, he calls it publish or perish. He says any eminent scientist who wishes to prove a theory has to come along with an article in a good journal, describe his research, show the facts, be convincing, and explain the basis of his theory. He says, it's never happened. From 1859 till now, it's never ever happened in that manner on this particular theory. And yet there are millions of people around the world who still cling to this strange notion that life is accident. And as Bear himself says, this Professor Dawkins makes it quite clear that he is an atheist. Brother Vigdanil explained, they want to use this as a weapon to absolve themselves of responsibility. That those who know better and are delighted to take on the task of Avodas Hashem can take great delight in having nowadays revelations, modern revelations, which are put before us to make us appreciate even more things which our own parents and grandparents didn't have the benefit of finding out about. We've got even more finding out about. No, so where are all the extra people who should be putting on to fill in? We have so much staring at us in the face that we would be blind to suggest that the human race comes from such weird sources like monkeys. And the school textbooks of the Goyim still continue printing year after year, edition after edition, all this nonsense as though it is fact, without even possibly suggesting that there is a much easier answer to explain it all. And therefore, when we read the Akdamus and we end off at the end, Zakoin, those who merit it, who merit to see the truth. Those people, I'll read from the English, righteous ones, just as if you heard the praise within this song and all the wonderful things about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so you too may be appointed among that company, that you're privileged to be seated in the front row if you listen to Hashem's words that emanate in majesty. Merom Hu Elohim, the Kadmo Vasraiso. Hashem is exalted. We cannot appreciate how great Hashem really is. But when all is done, and we've seen a little bit through the keyhole about the godless of the Bria, then we are glad to know that also He desired and selected us, and He gave us the Torah. May you all have a very good Kabbalah HaTorah. Good job to you.